are listening to The Kevin Smith Show.
Comments and views expressed on The Kevin Smith Show are those of the people who make them and do not necessarily represent the views of Kevin Smith, The Kevin Smith Show, or any of its affiliates or advertisers. Hi, folks, and welcome to The Kevin Smith Show, whoever you are, wherever you are, all around this gorgeous place we call Earth. Thank you for being here at The Kevin Smith Show. Now, there are always a lot of people tuned in who are tuning in for the very, very first time. And if you are, in fact, tuning in to The Kevin Smith Show for the first time, welcome. We are glad that you're here, and I hope you make a habit out of it. It's a great habit to get into. And by the way, it's not fattening. No calories. If you are new, you need to know that we have a free weekly newsletter, and that free weekly newsletter is called the K-Files E-Zine. For those of you who don't know how to spell e-zine, and I'm not making fun of you, but there are lots and lots of people that they think I'm saying easy, like E-A-S-Y. No, it's e-zine, E-Z-I-N-E. Just go over to my website, kevinsmithshow.com, and when you get there, you'll find a button that in red letters has K-Files e-zine written on it. So just click that, and once you click it, you're going to discover that it only takes a few seconds for you to subscribe, and you can unsubscribe anytime you want to. It comes out each week, free of charge, no strings attached. So be sure you get over there and do that. Now, what do you think about crop circles? I have had folks write to me and say, you know, you don't do very many shows on crop circles. That's true, I don't do very many. And the reason I don't do very many shows on crop circles is because there's not very much new that you can say about crop circles that hasn't already been said. It's a great mystery. They truly are. But there's not just a great deal to say about crop circles, you know. There they are. We don't know how they got there, but there they are. However, there's one that is particularly interesting to me that is fairly recent. Let me put the picture up. There's a picture of it right there, if you're looking at our video. It's a pentagon-shaped thing. It's got a star in it, and then lines connecting the points of the star make a sort of a pentagon shape. And then, of course, the rings around it. That is elaborate, to say the least, and it appeared back, I believe, on August the 14th, and it's fascinating. It appeared in England in a place called Barton, B-A-R-T-O-N, Barton, and so it's caused a bit of a stir, a bit of a controversy. Some people, of course, are saying, well, it's man-made, and some people are saying, no, it couldn't be man-made. If just you look at it, it's way too precise. People stomping crops down in the nighttime could not have been that precise. And I have to admit, if you look at some of the large pictures of it, I cannot make that one large. I don't think I can. I can move it around, but I can't make it any larger. Let me see here. Yeah, I can. There we go. Take a look at that, huh? That is elaborate, is it not? My guest this evening is none other than Glenn Kimble. He'll join us when we come back on the other side of this break. Welcome back. This is the Kevin Smith Show. I am the Kevin Smith, and my guest is Glenn Kimble. He's no stranger to those of you who listen to the show on a regular basis. He's been with us several times. We went for quite a while where he wasn't with us, but he was with us last week. And I've asked him to come back and talk with us some more. Every time he is with us on this show, I get a lot of email from listeners who say, please have him back again soon. And he is a wealth of information, I can tell you. He is an expert on ancient texts. He's a collector of ancient texts. And because of his knowledge about all of these ancient texts from around the world, he is, I guess, in general, an upsetter of the establishment apple carts when it comes to the hidden history of our world, things they don't tell you about. Glenn, welcome back to the show.
It's always good to be with you, Kevin.
Glenn, when you were with us last week, you made mention of a letter that Jesus wrote. And I can't remember if you did that on the show or in a private conversation with me before or after the show. But it's intriguing, this thing about Jesus writing a letter. Now, I don't suppose there's anybody on the face of this planet that does not know the name Jesus, at least in what we would call the civilized world. People know, you know, and by civilized, I mean where people read and write, they know that name. Now, some people consider him to be God. Some people consider him just to be a great teacher. And they don't consider him to be a deity at all. Other people think of him simply as just a historical figure. There he is. No big deal. But there is one thing about him that most people never stop and think about, and that is, did he ever write anything? We have the accounts of his disciples as recorded in the New Testament. We have some other accounts that didn't make it into the Bible, but these are all written about him by other people. Now, he was a teacher. Apparently, a genius. And the reason I say that, when he was 12 years old, according to all accounts, he absolutely astounded the doctors and lawyers of religion down at the temple. Just astounded them. Asked them questions they had not even considered, and then answered them. So apparently, a great genius. You would think then that at some point in his life, he must have written something. And you say, indeed he did. Tell us about that.
Well, not only that, but he was a great scientific mind as well. And we think we have to turn back and use the Bible as a reference source, because everyone kind of knows about the Bible. But the Bible basically is Christianity's canon, is not all the writings. In fact, John said it best, and John was perhaps Jesus' favorite friend and apostle. He said, "And many things Jesus did, I suppose if they were all written, the world would not contain all the books that should be written." That's in John 21:25. Somewhere between what John said and what is in reality, 70-some-odd sayings that Jesus made in the Bible is a huge discrepancy. I mean, you take 70, and then you think about what it would take to fill the entire earth knee-deep with the words of Christ.
Well, yeah, I mean, if you stop and think about it, there is that statement that if we were to record, if we were to write down everything that he did and everything that he said, the whole earth could not contain the books. So that would indicate that he was quite a prolific speaker.
Well, without doubt, and quite a prolific writer as well.
Mm-hmm.
People say, well, where is that? And they always point to the Apocrypha, just that that's the only thing that's out there that remains. And it's not, obviously. Take the entire body of Apocrypha, and that's extending most liberal points of view with the most liberal understandings of Christ. It would be less than one-tenth of one-tenth of one-tenth of what Jesus left on the earth in terms of historical writings. And I pulled our bell one time a long time ago. I said that there are surviving in our day 5 million texts written by Jesus, his apostles, and his disciples. And he said, 5 million.
I'll have to amen that. 5 million?
I'm sorry I'm wrong. I'm conservative.
Okay.
On the side of there being a lot more than that.
Writings by Jesus and by his disciples.
And his disciples and apostles and people. Correct.
Well, if there's 5 million of these, then quite obviously a significant percentage of them would have to be written by Jesus himself, right?
That's correct. Now, Jesus was not ignorant. In the book, the Prot Evangelium, written by his brother James, it talks about we hear on our version of the Bible in the New Testament about the conversation that he was having at the 12, what he was talking to the scholars about. It infers that he was very smart, that he was something very wise. But in the Protevangelium, it actually gets into what he was teaching them. And this guy was a scientist. This guy really was talking about quantum mechanics and astrophysics.
Time out. We're going to get to that letter in just a minute. You mean to tell me, and this worldwide audience, that Jesus talked about quantum physics, quantum mechanics?
Without any doubt. In fact, the word ion itself comes from the Ionians, and the Ionians had one of the greatest libraries of Jesus in the history of the world. In fact, at one point in time, they had the largest library of the quotes of Jesus. And they didn't call ions after the Ionians for nothing, because the Ionians, the people from the Isle of Iona, were smart. They did it because they had the great libraries from the Grand Masters, and the greatest master of them all was Jesus, who taught about these kinds of scientific. I keep telling people we would do better if we were to reverse engineer our religions. Ever would by reverse engineering some sort of UFO that might fall to the earth. Because in our history of this planet, there are plenty of references to technology that existed in ancient days. I mean, we've had programs on the television talk about Neanderthals and came out of caves, etc. And we have this illusion that we have progressed over time from a very primitive battler society to the scientific monstrosity we see today that prints their circuit boards in Silicon Valley. But that's completely laughable. The truth is that we live in the dark ages of science and of religion, both of them. They knew more then than we know now. And I can give you some examples on the Easter Islands, had configured a machine that helped them to ward off tsunamis. We don't have that. they had the ability to affect hurricanes. We don't have that. We talk about it. We don't have it. They had the ability to do genetic engineering, which is the reason why the number one practice in their society was to take the umbilical cords and stash them in there in this great big tower so that kids could get well from the umbilical cords when they were born. That's just on Easter Island, and that was only 13 miles long and 7 miles wide.
All right, well, let's get back to this letter I know you're at the current time you're doing a lot of writing, and I think this is one of the things that you're working with is this letter of Jesus.
Yeah, it was first published in terms of mass public in the 4th century by Eusebius. Eusebius was a great man. He was the Archbishop of Caesarea. Most of you don't know what Caesarea was. Caesarea was the city just north of Nazareth on the seacoast. It was the end of the Silk Trade Route. They poured underwater concrete. It was the first port in the world where they had poured underwater concrete. You have to ask yourself the question, why in the world would they create the greatest seaport in the world off the coast of Judea, if in fact their television shows are right, that Judea was a conquered, diminished people? That's completely ridiculous. Jerusalem had made a pact 400 years prior to Jesus' time with Rome itself in the Roman Senate to be Roman allies. They weren't a conquered people. They were voluntary allies of the Roman Empire. But Eusebius knew this, and Eusebius, because of his position as being the ecclesiastical authority of Caesarea, had the best of all worlds. He had the greatest library in the world at that moment in time. And in that library were all the documents that from Greece, from Jerusalem, from Rome, from England, from the Far East along the Silk Trade Route. That was probably the very best of the materials he had. And he had tons and tons and tons of material written by Christ and by Jesus and by his apostles and disciples, most of which has been either taken to the great libraries at the Hagia Sophia in Istanbul, or placed in the Vatican libraries, or even taken to the great libraries in the College at Oxford in England.
All right. So how is it that you have access to this letter if everything seems to have been spirited away to these various secret libraries? And by secret, it's not a secret that the library is there, but we're talking about this material being in libraries that you can't walk in off the street and say, okay, I want to go look at the writings by Jesus. How many people actually ever get to go into the Vatican Library and into the more classified, if you will, areas?
They don't usually get to get into the Vatican Library, but in the case of this letter, it's published form in our public library systems since the beginning of this country.
All right. This letter is contained within some writings by Eusebius, right?
By Eusebius, and those have been published for hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years. And it contains that letter. It was one of the things that Eusebius prized, was the fact that he not only had the letter written by Jesus, but he had the letter written by Akbarus, who was the instigator, great King Akbarus, who was the Edessa, who wrote him the original letter to begin with. You know, we talk about collections of letters. Usually you'd collect the letters from somebody, but you wouldn't collect letters from somebody.
Yeah, you get one side of the conversation, usually.
You get one side of the conversation. Eusebius was very, very good at collecting the letters from both sides of the conversation. In this particular case, we not only have the letter written by Jesus to Akbarus, but we have the letter from Akbarus to Jesus. And in what it appears to say in that letter was I know exactly who you are. I know exactly what you do. I want you to return here to the East because I'm sick now, and I'd like to have you heal me of my illness. Now, please come back, because you're living amongst the Jews. We're going to kill you.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus says, I can't. It's my final ministry. I'm not going to go back, indicating that he had already been there once before and taught in the great schools along the Silk Trade route. We know that because we have his writings along the Silk Trade route all the way into China.
All right. Now, this king, I believe you say his name is Akbaris. He was king of where?
Now, Akbaris, the king of Edessa. Now, Edessa is a city right between the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, real close to Macedonia, very close to Caesarea, not very far. King Akbaris was very, very, very famous. As a matter of fact, if you go to Spain today, the newest of their super buildings, the great big giant buildings that they built there in Spain,
mm-hmm.
called the Building of Akbaris.
Hmm.
Not a Spanish name at all.
Yeah. Well, of course, you know, I know you know this, but some of our listeners may or may not know that there was a time when Spain was ruled by the Ottoman Empire.
That's true. There was a time that it was. It was also a time when Spain, France, and southern part of England were a place called Gaul, G-A-L. And people have asked, people don't realize what that really means. Gaul was named after Galtheus. Galtheus was a Macedonian mercenary who lived very, his hometown was very close to King Akbaris. As a matter of fact, in this Macedonian museum to this very day, you can walk straight through the door without any kind of a pass at all, and you can see the loot that the Cathalus took out of Egypt at the time of Moses, at the time of the Exodus. It's absolutely spectacular. And you say, well, how come Cathalus has all this Egyptian loot from the time of the Exodus on display in a freaking museum in Macedonia?
That's a good question. Why?
Well, the answer is pretty clear in that that Cathalus was a mercenary from Greece, fought alongside Moses at the time of the Ethiopian Wars. And when the Exodus occurred, the 11 brothers who had sold their brother into slavery were required to exit Egypt through the Sinai, spent 40 years in the desert. But the Joseph, who had committed no sin, he was the brother that was innocent. He was the one sold into slavery. His descendants went out with the great pharaonic queen Scota, who was given to Cathalus as a spouse. They sailed down the Nile River with a boat full of their loot and put it in the Macedonian Museum. And then after they lived there for a period of time, they looked for a country of their own.
Now, wait a minute. You mean this Macedonian Museum was in existence back then?
No. No, it was a spitting distance on a boat. I mean, well, you had to cross all of Judea, but you're talking about a 6 or 7 day trip.
Yeah, but the Macedonian Museum was there then?
It wasn't a Macedonian Museum, I'm sorry. It was Macedonia, the city.
Ah. Okay. And now, in this modern world that we live in, there are two Macedonians. There is the Macedonian, or the Greek province called Macedonia, and then there is a independent republic that used to be part of Yugoslavia called Macedonia. So we're talking about in the Greek province, right?
Yep.
Okay.
And they sailed out to the west looking for a place to live in peace. They landed on the shores of Spain, and the Spanish saw this mercenary group coming in an armada of vessels. They start a little skirmish, and of course the mercenaries were well skilled in the art of war, defeated the Spanish with one tied behind their back. And the Spanish gave them a country which was called the port of Athulis.
All right, we have to take a break, and we'll continue with that when we come back. My guest is Glenn Kimble, and we're going to talk more in detail about what's in this letter and also what may still be out there that we haven't heard about. We'll be back right after this. We are back, and this is the Kevin Smith Show. I am Kevin Smith, and my guest this evening is Glenn Kimble. Glenn, let's go back to this letter just a bit. I've got a few questions about this thing. First of all, there was a letter from this king, Akbarus, to Jesus, right?
Right.
Okay. And then there is a response from Jesus back to this king. All right.
That's right.
All right. So now tell us in as much detail as you can about this response that Jesus wrote back to the king. The king is asking him to come back to his kingdom and heal him, basically, right?
That's correct. That assumes that this king already knew who Jesus was and had some confidence in him that it could heal him of his disease. You wouldn't just send to Mahatma Gandhi a letter saying, you know, I'm president of the United States. Why don't you come over here and tell me about non-aggression pact?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you would, but probably not, and especially not in there at the time. Akbarus was one of the members of a very ancient fraternity called the Magi. Now, these Magi characters transcended many different cultures and people. Most of the historians would tell you that of the three major Magi that came to visit the birth of Christ, one of them came from Persia, or very, very, very close place where King Akbarus had his kingdom. One of them came from Saudi Arabia, and one of them India.
All right. Now, the Magi were actually, I mean, their roots go all the way back into Persia, right?
Well, certainly, if you were to ask the Kashmirians tell you that all 12 of the Magi came from Persia, but that's not true. That'd be like saying that all good things came from being a Democrat or from being a Republican. That's not true. In Kashmir, they have homes for everybody. They counted the wealth and prestige of their countries based on who was buried there. They have the tomb of the Virgin Mary and Joseph the Carpenter. They even had the tomb of a donkey that Jesus rode on.
In Kashmir. Okay. But the Magi were basically, they were kingmakers, weren't they? I mean, they were the ones who decided who was ordained of the heavens to be king, right?
The Magi were a priesthood, much like the Masonic Order is today.
Okay.
You had to have achieved a certain level. You had to have the initiatory services. Then you had to have also officiated in a temple. These people extended a long time before Abraham, Isaac, Jacob. And in fact, some of those people, Gibelmite, some of the most original ones of the Magi.
Okay.
If you look at the Masonic Order materials today, for example, the ring or the sword they use if aids within the Masonic Order, it has a big G on the hilt of the sword,
mm-hmm.
has a big G on the ring.
Yeah.
Well, that G represents Gibelmite. Even the Masonic don't really. But most of the 33-degree Masons don't understand.
Yeah, I don't know what's happening. Your phone is breaking up something fierce. We're barely able to understand what you're saying. Are you on a landline, Glenn?
I am on a landline, and I'll try and hold very still.
Okay. So the king writes to him and says, I'd like for you to come back. And what was the response?
And the response of Jesus is that he obviously knew what was going to happen. I cannot, but I will send another in my place, and he will heal you of your disease. And the person that he sent back in his place was his younger brother, Thomas. Thomas went after the crucifixion. To be honest with you, Thomas was the doubting Thomas. He was the brother of Christ, and Jesus said it best, man is not without honor except his home city and amongst his own family. Thomas gave him a lot of trouble when he was growing up. But he sent Thomas, wanted to send Thomas back to India to, like he had done before, and Thomas didn't want to do it. So Jesus arranged to have Thomas sold as a slave to Jesus' own great uncle, Joseph of Arimathea, and Joseph of Arimathea took back to India.
Wait a minute. Who sold Thomas as a slave?
Jesus.
Jesus sold Thomas as a slave?
Yeah, but it was more of an indentured servitude than it was a slavery. And the person Thomas took with him when he went back to India, where Jesus had taught amongst some of the Magi schools there along the Silk Trade route, was he took a lady called Lady of Magdala, or Mary Magdalene, because she had come from that place. She'd come from the region of Kashmir, and she had been widely held as being one of the priestesses of the Magi. In fact, to this very day, if you go to India or Kashmir, they still have colleges called the University of Mary Magdalene. She went back with him, but then she came back out of India. Thomas had his problems, and she sailed to the coast of Brittany with Joseph of Arimathea, roughly in the year 1648.
Yeah, it's you're breaking up again really bad. 16 what?
48 A.D.
1648 A.D.
Oh, 48 A.D.
Oh, okay. I don't know why I said 16. Yeah, in 48 A.D.
Right.
Okay, now, Joseph of Arimathea, it's well known that he was a wealthy man and that he was a trader. He was in business, and so we know that he traveled a lot. And so what you're saying is that Jesus wrote to this king and said, I'll send someone to you that will heal you. And then you're saying that he sent Thomas.
Right.
Okay. How do we know that? Is that in the letter?
Well, we have an enormous library of the activities of Thomas in India and in Kashmir and up in through Odessa as well.
Okay.
And we call those things the Gnostic libraries, even though the Gnostic libraries are but a fragment of all the letters and all the documents that do exist in our day. In fact, the largest collection of the words and sayings of this is not in the Holy Bible. It's in the Gospel of Thomas.
All right. Now, who wrote the Gospel of Thomas?
Thomas.
Okay. So it's been verified all the way back to him, right?
That's correct.
All right. Now, does it differ in any significant way from the other Gospels that we know about?
Of course, because it's bigger.
Okay. Now, does he, in this Gospel of Thomas, does Thomas write about any of this trip to see the king?
No, but he does write about visiting the king and some of the other... And some of the other documents written by Thomas. Thomas was a prolific writer, much like his older brother Jesus. And we have one of the things that he had asked from the king was to... the king wanted Thomas to build him a palace. And Thomas having a parentage that were builders, said, sure, I'll build you a palace. And he says, but it's going to cost you so much money. And so the king gave him a large sum of money. And then when the king came back to look at, find out the progress on the palace, not one thing had been done. And Thomas had given all the money to the poor and the needy. And the king says, you know, I'm about ready to boil you here in oil. What'd you do with the money? And he said, I gave it to the poor and needy, but I built you a palace in heaven where moth does not corrupt, or thieves break through and steal. It's quite a great story written by Thomas.
Now, what was the reaction of the king to that?
Well, after you've got healed from your illnesses and you became a fledgling disciple of this movement, this Christian movement, he realized that you couldn't take a palace with you to heaven, that it's much better to have one there waiting for you when you get there. So, he
was a much more gracious individual than I would have been. I would have called that false advertising, and I would have gotten my money back, or somebody would have gone to jail for fraud.
It depends upon what you value most. In our society, we value money, we value our prestige, we value things differently. In their day, they not only valued their money, but they valued their honor. As a matter of fact, oftentimes they were confused between the two of them. They often said that the gifts of gold were gifts of honor. They were confused between the two. But nevertheless, the things that we value in our day are not the same kind of things that they valued in their day.
That's just... and of course I know, I mean, we're sitting here centuries later and I'm passing judgment on something. But, you know, I got to tell you, to me, I would have to say there wasn't much honor in Thomas. That sounds like deception to me.
Well, I think Thomas had a few character flaws all the way from the time he was born till the time he died. One of the character flaws was the fact that he gave Jesus problems all of his life. Certain that Thomas was the quintessential of all the apostles. John the Beloved was probably the senior of the group. Some people say Peter not. John the Beloved, Mark, though he wasn't one of the original 12, would have been one of the senior people. All because he wrote so much and was educated in Heliopolis with Mark. Then there were other apostles that were various and sundry degrees. As a matter of fact, John asked Jesus one time on one occasion, some of the apostles are better than others. Some of them teach only some of your words, and some of them teach all of your words. Just said that's the way it was always intended to be.
All right, now back to the letter. Is there anything in that letter that is eye-popping information, something that really stands out and says, whoa, you need to look at this?
Well, I think the fact that the terms that he uses, the fact that it came from the Far East, or came from east of the River Jordan, the fact that it indicates that there were records written by Jesus in the east, and that they were taken all the way to the west coast by Joseph of Arimathea, is in and of itself startling information. The actual correspondence between the king and Jesus was maybe not so much a doctrinal issue or advanced cause of moral values, but the fact the letter does exist, and that it came from such writing various varied sources, and then sent it such a long ways away, give us a clue as to what has happened to our religions.
All right, we have to take a break, Glenn, and we'll be back on the other side of this break, more with this hidden history stuff. Boy, I'll tell you what, every time you get Glenn on the phone, you find out things you didn't know. We'll be back right after this. Thank you. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I am Kevin Smith, your host, and my guest this evening is Glenn Kimble. Glenn, when we start thinking about this letter and the references that are made to "I'm not coming back," that does indicate that he must have been there previously. But you said that apparently his writings have shown up all along the Silk trade route.
Yeah, without any doubt, they had been. If you explore the Silk trade route today, you still see oasis every 100 miles. And each of these little cities that were along the Silk trade route into China had their own militia, militia meaning their own local army. They also had their own school. And so when Jesus came from the Far East, you know, one of the places claims to still have the body of Christ, silly, but nevertheless is in Japan.
And I've seen that on a documentary.
They have an enormous library of the words of Christ in Japan, of the things that he taught, etc., etc.
Now let me ask you a question, and I'm quite serious about this. Why, when they claim they have the body, the grave of Christ containing, I guess, the remains in Japan, why, and we know that can't be true, why would we believe the veracity of any documents they have?
In their day and age, the thing that people valued most was the tombs that they claimed to own. And I think those things were all, there's not enough bodies to go around. All the people that they claimed to be buried in various and sundry locations. Western Christianity, for example, thinks that John the Beloved was buried in Ephesus, which is not true. If you read the story in Ephesus, go to Ephesus and read the story. The story is that the only thing that they found there where the cathedral is, that it was supposedly the tomb of John the Beloved. The only thing that they found was his shoes and a ring.
A ring?
They didn't find his body.
Uh-huh.
Jesus had promised John that he would send him on a mission to the Far East or to Asia, and that is confirmed by Eusebius, who was the chief Nicene father at the Nicene Council, that John the Beloved went to the Far East. And there's a reason for that. And this is terribly important. At the time of the prophet Eber, Eber was the prophet of all the Hebrew nations. Eber, Hebrew. Everyone that's a descendant of Eber is Hebrew. He had sons. One was Peleg, and one was Joktan. One son went west, became the patriarch of Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, and all kinds of others. But the other son went to the east, the lands of the greater population, which it was into China and obviously into Japan, which didn't exist at that time. But part of the reason why Jesus' ministry had to go to the Far East was because they were Hebrew. Many of the people that went into their locations were Hebrew. We have the Eastern Orthodox faith and the earliest Nestorian Christian churches merged at some point in time, and they have a collection of books, which they call the Book of the Bee, or the beehive was the symbol of the Hebrew nation. This was their version of the Holy Bible. It still exists. It's been published for, they still use it in their chapels. It's still part of their canon. We don't use it because we're from the West. But, you know, the amounts of books with the words of Jesus and the sayings of Jesus in it extend around the world.
I pose the question about how, you know, with artwork and with antiques, they talk about the provenance, the pedigree, if you will, the chain of custody, so that you can verify the veracity of what you're looking at. How do we know? I mean, just because we have a book that claims to have the teachings of Jesus in it, how do we know that that is accurate?
Well, I can assure you one thing, that there are no accurate books, including the Bible. They all have problems with.
Okay.
David Roll, who wrote that great book, A Test of Time from Great Britain, 100 pages long, tells us about the fact that the Old Testament is probably 400 years off in its dating process. The scholars have screwed up 400 years. I don't think there's a correct book that's out there, but in terms of provenance, the Eastern Bible has every bit as much provenance as the Western Bible, and was in use prior to the Western Bible. We didn't get
If it was in use prior to the Western Bible, it actually has a better pedigree.
It does. It does have a better pedigree. Now, think of it this way. Think of it this way. Ireland. What was the very first name of Ireland?
I don't know.
Hibernia.
Oh, okay.
Now, Hibernia or Hibernia is the same as Eberland, or the prophet Eber, or the land of the Ebers, or the land of the Hebrews. Ireland was every bit as part of this Hebrew movement as China was, and as were the Romans, or Jerusalem for that matter. People track themselves based on their pedigree much more so in their day than we do in our day. Our day, who cares about who your father was, unless he was president of the United States, you know.
Well, yeah, and look, you know, especially I think that's true here in the United States. All of us are either immigrants, or we are the sons, grandsons, great-grandsons of immigrants. And, you know, a portion of my family came over from Germany, and a portion from Ireland. And then a portion of my family were here on the shores waiting to meet them. I'm part Native American.
Here's the point.
I haven't traced my family back and found out, you know, where did we come from in Germany, and trace it to who are my surviving relatives there now. Frankly, I don't care.
Well, my dad traced that was his hobby, was genealogy.
Mm-hmm.
And once you get back into the kings of Europe, it's fairly simple because they're a matter of public record. My father's traced his lineage back before Jesus. So I know exactly where a portion of my family. And so what, you know?
My attitude about it, and there's a point I'm going to make with this. All of those ancestors, they're not around now. It may be interesting to know, but they're not paying my bills. And all of my scattered relatives that are scattered across Europe, they're not paying my bills. And so the people that matter to me are the people, my family and my friends, people that I live around, even though they're not paying the bills either, I am. But, the only people that I really care about are sort of current around me.
Well, that wasn't always the case in history.
Yeah, I know. What happened?
But there was a time when if you were a distant member of the family, you were welcomed in and you dined and you stayed for a year. Those days are long gone. We don't even let our neighbors come into our yard if they bring their pit bull, you know.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So we have Jesus, his writings. Now, is it just his sayings, or is it actually his writings that are scattered along the Silk Route?
Both.
So then what you're saying is that Jesus himself actually physically traveled that Silk Route.
Actually physically traveled. And why would that be the case? Let me explain why. His great uncle, by the Jesus' earthly father, Joseph the Carpenter, we call him Joseph the Carpenter, died when Jesus was about 15 years old. We know because we have the document of his death. Okay? Pardon me, I'm the document guy, all right? And the guy that, under Jewish law, that took over the protectorship of the Virgin Mary and her fledgling little family was Joseph of Arimathea. Now, what did Joseph of Arimathea do? Well, first of all, Joseph of Arimathea had been appointed to the post of noblest decurio by Tiberius Caesar himself. In other words, Jesus' family were extremely prominent Roman citizens, whether we like it or whether we don't. And Joseph of Arimathea was a tin and lead trader.
All right, we have to take a break. Don't forget where we are. I want to pick up right there when we come back. All right, ladies and gentlemen, more with this intriguing story. You like the Da Vinci Code? Hey, this goes further and deeper. We'll be back right after this. And welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. I'm Kevin Smith, your host. My guest this evening is Glenn Kimball. Glenn, you were talking about what happened when Jesus was about 15 years old. Now, you're saying his earthly father, Joseph, died. And we have the document of his death. Basically, I guess, a death certificate. What we would call today a death certificate. Joseph of Arimathea was given the protectorship of Mary and her family. That would include Jesus and his brothers and sisters. And then, now, how is he related to the family?
Well, Joseph had been married once before and had had children, a couple of older daughters, a couple of older sons, and
Now you're talking about Joseph, the father or earthly father of Jesus.
Yeah, you can find that in Matthew 13, 55 and 56. You can say that Jesus didn't have brothers and sisters, and that's preposterous. According to the Western Bible, that's preposterous. And the fact that Jesus had... You talk about prominence of Jesus' family, younger brothers, is so enormous that it's very difficult to deny that he had brothers.
Okay, but how is Joseph of Arimathea related?
Joseph of Arimathea was the Virgin Mary's uncle. The Virgin Mary's mother, great Saint Anna, who was born in Brittany, by the way, not born in Judea. And we know basically a lot about her because of a document that is called the Gospel of the Virgin Mary. The Vatican just as soon you not know about, even though it's the Gospel of the Virgin Mary.
All right. So now he takes control of the family, and then and you're saying that they were well off. Now there are indications of that, and I've pointed this out before. The problem, you know, here's the problem when you get into these discussions. I find this whole topic fascinating, but you get into these, and there's so much religion hanging all over everything once you walk into this subject, once you start talking about Jesus. There's like layers and layers and millennia of religion just dripping off of all of it, and people get so emotional about it. But I've pointed this out. Even in what you're calling the Western Bible, there are indications that Jesus was a man of personal wealth. And let me just point out some of that and see what you think about it. Number one, he keeps getting invited to dinner at the homes of the most wealthy and prominent lawyers and business people. Number two, when he died, his garment had been woven without seam. It was tailor-made and was of such value that when they were gambling for his possessions, or when they were dividing up his possessions, the soldier said, "Let's gamble for this. You don't want to split this up." Why? Because it's valuable.
Yeah, he got it from the Far East. the clothing that he wore was, sometimes he wore the rocks of a impoverished citizen because he made his apostles work for a living. Didn't feel like that they should live off their own monies and estate any more than he felt that he should do so himself. Found that morally objectionable, and he made them work for a living with their hands. And they hated it. Many of the apostles were wealthy. Mark's family was extremely wealthy. Peter owned a fishing business. And you don't give away your fishing business and not be worth some dough, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And we know how wealthy Jesus' family was because they used to feed 5,000 people on occasion. The Virgin Mary's house was always a place where you could come and be fed. Those stories abound. If you were impoverished and didn't have enough food to feed your own family, you certainly wouldn't be out there feeding the poor neighbors. And Mary came to Bethlehem on a burro. Pardon me, they didn't have Lexus, the cars in those days, but she rode on a very nice burro. Most of the rest of the people walked, you know.
All right, now, that being all true, Glenn, you know that I have gotten into some hot water from time to time by some of the statements that I've made about the nature and origins of Jesus. And I have said that, number one, if there is a God and it is the God of the Bible, assuming that's true, you're talking about an extraterrestrial. I didn't say you're talking about a little green man. I said you're talking about an extraterrestrial. He can't.
Of course you are.
Yeah, he can't be from. If he's not from here, then he is extraterrestrial. And if he created here, he's not from here. So when you look at that, then you're talking about an extraterrestrial. And then if you take what the Bible says, that what the New Testament says about the parentage of Jesus, it says that Mary was his mother, but that his father was God himself. Therefore, you have Jesus being an extraterrestrial human hybrid.
I'll buy that.
You will. Well, you're going to be in the same hot water. You're going to be in the same hot water I'm in.
Well, we go back into history, back in the Egyptian technology history. The Egyptians, we look at the prophet Jacob, for example, whose sons.
The prophet who?
Egypt.
Which prophet?
Pardon?
You said if you look at the prophet, and then you broke up. We couldn't hear.
Yeah, the prophet Jacob.
Jacob.
Whose sons sold their little brother into slavery into Egypt.
Yeah.
His name was changed to what?
Israel.
Israel, or Israel. Got to break that word up in order to understand it. Buddha Isa, or the prophet Isis, or we know who the Buddha Isa was. The Buddha Isa left his writings for us. He says, "My name is Jesus." Okay?
Okay.
You know who that is. Isa, Ra is the sun god, the unbegotten one, and El is the god of the Old Testament. So, and Israel I think that was the Egyptian terminology for Jacob, who came with his son into Egypt. But the Egyptians were very famous for their building of their temples. One of the very first temples that predated the Temple of Solomon was the Temple of Amarna. the Temple of Amarna, which is on the east coast of the Nile River, not on the west coast, if you've ever been to Egypt.
I never have. I've been to a lot of this world, but I've never been to Egypt.
Well, Amarna was the first place where the Ark of the Covenant sat. And how do we know that? Because we know that because of the Macedonian Museum artifact. In the Macedonian Museum artifacts that were taken from the time of the Exodus at the time of Moses, we have little medallions of the priests with the Ark of the Covenant on it that came from the Temple of Amarna. And who built the Temple of Amarna? Akhenaten, or Akhen, priest of Anat, Akhenaten, the priest of the religion Aten.
Okay.
And so he was very definitely, he changed religion for an entire generation in the Pharaonic history. And he told the people, he says, the old gods that we used are all our own story. The real God is somebody different, and he built a temple to him. They destroyed that temple. But that temple, the artifacts from that temple, were taken out of Egypt on the boats of Gephelus to Macedonia. That's where they are to this very day. As a matter of fact, in Macedonia, they have a map, very nice map from the time of Moses. They have the temple veil with the three lions on it from the time of Moses. I mean, this is what they have in Macedonia is, you sit back and you look at this thing and you go, holy cow, where have I been all my life?
And, okay, so what's the upshot of this? First of all, it's quite obvious. We're going to open the telephone lines here in just a moment for the audience to call in. But what's the sum of this? You've painted for us a very, very different picture of this guy Jesus than what has been painted for us in Sunday schools and in the churches. You haven't said anything that makes him less of what they teach, but it's very different. But what's the sum of it?
We live in the dark ages of both science and religion. You know, we go back to Spencer Tracy and Hair at the Wind, you know, that movie. And his object was, if he could prove that there was a human being before 6000 B.C., that the Bible was a phony. And my comment is, who in the world taught you about religion, you know? There were people in the Khyber Pass 40,000 years ago, long before Adam and Eve came to this world. Adam and Eve came into a world where there were people called the men of old and the men of renown. How can you have the men of old when you're the first guy there, you know? How can you have men of renown if you're the first guy there, you know?
Well, that is true, and, you know, even Genesis tells you that there was a race of humans that was created on day six in the creation account, and then on day seven, the gods rested, and then after day seven, the Lord God comes around and creates Adam. After day seven.
Adam was the patriarch of the final epoch of time. All of the cultures from India to Egypt to Russia, China, to Jerusalem, Greece, to Rome, to England, to the Americas, in the Americas, it's beautiful with the Mayans and the Toltecs. They tell the story better than anybody. There were four epochs of human beings that lived on the earth who destroyed themselves, and these, I'm going to quote Plato here, who destroyed themselves because they violated the laws of the earth and of God. And we're in that time period where Hesiod in the 8th century B.C., who lived at the time of Homer, said you'll be able to recognize the end of time because the end of time will be filled with skeptics and darkness and ignorance, arrogance. He says, and you can recognize them because they have devolved into factionalism. And holy cow, that describes us pretty good.
It really does.
And even our science is, I mean, we don't know a tenth of the science that they knew in those days. I mean, we think we do because we drive Lexus and we live in nice houses. We're wrong. They lived better than we did. They traveled better than we did. They flew in the air better than we did. They went from one place to another better than we did. Their agriculture was better than ours. Their understanding of quantum mechanics and astrophysics was better than ours. I'm sorry, we live in the dark ages.
Wow. All right, I'll tell you what we're going to do. We're going to open the telephone and invite our audience, if you have questions or comments for Glenn. The telephone number is on your screen, but let me say it audibly for those of you who are not watching our video. We have a video feed, but it is a radio show. 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. That's the number for you to call if you have a question or if you have a comment for Glenn Kimball. And the telephone line is open for you right now, all right? And it'll be our first test of this system since we have repaired it. You know, we got that big lightning storm we had really messed up it messed up our internet. Cox Cable had to come out and do a lot of work because of that. But it also messed up some of our equipment. And this will be the first test since then of this telephone system. So, again, it is 602-539-9580. Glenn, it would be no surprise to you, I am sure, if we have people who call in and say, well, I disagree with this guy, and I disagree with you too, Smith. You know, both of you guys are all wet when it comes to you're talking about Jesus and you know nothing about him. Have you run into that before?
They have to disagree because they don't know. I mean, I disagree with things I don't know. I disagree, you know, up until now, I've had a general philosophical understanding of UFOs and kind of thought, well, that's probably true. But I saw one, you know, James Killian's ranch. And there's a lot of difference between being generically favorable and having absolute evidence.
Yeah. All right, let's go to the telephone. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from? Hello, caller. Ah, hang on just a moment. For some reason. There we go. Caller, are you with me? Hello, caller. Well, whoever it is or was has chosen not to speak. All right, there we go. The telephone number is 602-539-9580. And if you have a question or a comment, please feel free to give us a call. What you're saying is there's theory and then there's experience.
Well, there is. And, you know, people are like onions. You know, you can criticize my shoes, and I'm not going to be really super offended. But you criticize the color of my hair, I get a little more offended. You criticize my family, I'm going to get real angry. You critique me and my beliefs, and you got fighting words. You know, it goes down to the center core. And when we're talking about Jesus, it tends to be talking about something that believe. I wish I had a church to tell you, but I don't. I'm not Jimmy Jones. I'm not David Koresh. I never will be. I'm not in that. I won't ever be clergy. And that's probably the greatest difference between me and most of the other people who speak about Jesus is that I refuse to speak about being the corner palmist or the corner spiritualist in any way, shape, or form. I get calls all the time, people asking me, how do I heal my body, or what's going to be in the future, And my comment is, how the heck do I know?
All right, now, I think it's important that, you know, people, by the way, and those of you who are watching me making all kinds of adjustments on the mixer. But I think it's important for people to realize that just because we're making observations about what we think is the case with all these documents, that doesn't mean that we're setting up any kind of new religion. All right, caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
It's Tony from Alberta.
Hello, Tony.
How are you?
I'm doing well, sir. What's on your mind?
I'd like to ask a question to your guest.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I was just wondering, how old was Joseph when he died? The one, you know, the father, the Christian father of Mary.
All right, you're talking about the father of Jesus?
The father of Jesus, yeah.
And how old was he when he died, Glenn?
Well, there are various and sundry opinions of that, depending upon which of the historical schools you go to. Some people say he was as old as 80 years old when he married the Virgin Mary. I don't buy that myself. I think he had four children that were adult children. I suspect 40s. That the average age at that particular moment in history was when people died was somewhere in the late 30s, early 40s. I suspect that he was probably somewhere in his late 40s and early 50s when he met the Virgin Mary, and he probably died in his 60s.
Okay.
So how old was he when he married her?
Well, like I say, there are some historical records that say he was very old, that he was around 80. I think they're guesses.
You mean when he married, he was around 80?
That's a guess, okay, on the part of historians.
I heard that too, and I thought, man, that doesn't seem right. But so then he had to be over 100 when he died?
No.
That's exactly my point, is that I think that that's preposterous. I think he was probably in his 60s when he...
Okay, so you think he was in his 50s when he died?
Probably in his 60s when he died.
Okay, you're saying he was in his 60s when he died.
Yeah.
Okay. You guys are talking on top of each other, so...
Okay.
Tony, go ahead with your question.
Yeah, I was wondering, how old was Mary when she married Joseph?
We know that Mary entered the temple for her own protection. Everyone knew exactly who she was when she was 3 years old. We knew that there was an edict sent out, because we have copies of the edict, when she was 15 years old, saying she was of marriage age. She was probably 16 or 17 when she got married.
Okay. And Joseph was how old?
Probably in his 40s.
I didn't get that.
Probably in his 40s. We're barely getting you, Tony.
Was that right?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, you got to speak right into your phone.
I'm speaking right into the phone.
Now
you can hear me now?
Yes, we can.
Okay. So what you're saying is he was
in his 40s when he married Mary, he was around 40,
and when he died, he was around 50?
60.
60, so he only lived another 20 years, in other words.
Yeah.
Well,
I always thought that he was around 21 when he married Mary.
Oh, well, you can hear anything. Nobody knows. That's the point. Nobody knows.
Like, Joseph was like 21 in his 20s.
Couldn't have been 21 for the following reason. He already had four kids.
Yeah. Did you hear that, Tony? Could not have been 21. He already had four kids.
Well, he had four kids before he married.
That's right.
He was married before he got married to Mary?
Yes, and his wife had died and left him a widower. He was always called the lonely widower in documents.
All right, Tony, we're going to have to move along. We have other callers, but thanks so much for the call. We appreciate it. All right, ladies and gentlemen, it is mysterious. We hear all kinds of stories about Jesus, and some of what we hear may or may not be true. Some of what these documents that Glenn is talking about tonight, some of what they say may or may not be true. But that's why we're here to talk about them. We have to take a break, and when we come back from this break, we'll continue with your telephone calls at 602-539-9580. Back to the Kevin Smith Show, and my guest, Glenn Kimball. Let me turn the telephone line back on. Sometimes folks don't understand why we do that, but look, if you've listened to this show for any length of time, you know if I answer the telephone during a commercial break and put somebody on hold, they always hang up, almost always hang up before we get out of break. So anyway, the telephone line is open. If you're trying to call in, now's the time, okay? Glenn, before we go any further, I want to make a point that I think we need to make as part of what we're talking about here. One of the things, you know, I mentioned the Da Vinci Code earlier. One of the things that's in all of this information, we haven't talked about it tonight, but it's in all of this body of information, is that Jesus was married, and he was married to the person we know as Mary Magdalene. And we haven't talked about that, but one of the things, one of the arguments that I hear against that is when people say, well, I don't believe that Jesus was married because it doesn't say so in the Bible. Well, an argument from silence is spurious from start to finish. It also doesn't say that he combed his hair. It also doesn't say that he took a bath. I would assume that in his 33 years, he combed his hair at least once. I would assume that he took a bath sometime. But you can't say, well, okay, we're Christians and we're not going to take a bath because the Bible doesn't say that Jesus took a bath. That would be spurious. And the same thing is true when you say, well, we know he wasn't married because the Bible doesn't mention it. Well, it's a spurious argument. All right, let's go to the telephone, and let's see. Caller, you are live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Dale, and I'm from Long Beach.
Okay, Dale from Long Beach.
Yes. I'm thinking about Mary, when she married Joseph, and when she was 16 and he was probably in his 40s or 50s. Was this common for a man of his age to marry this, a younger person with this much age difference? And why is it so different today, viewing the age difference?
Okay, before you go any further, how old am I? Do you know, Dale?
Pardon? 54. No, 55.
I'm 55. Do you know how old my wife is?
No.
30.
30?
Yep.
Well, there's 50 years between me and my husband.
Okay, Dale, I'm going to release your call and let him answer that question, and you can listen off air, okay?
Okay, thank you.
Thank you so much for the call. All right, what about that?
Well, there's a document that talks about the betrothal of the Virgin Mary to Joseph. Joseph did not feel like he was in the age category of Mary. When the edict came out asking for to apply, I guess, for as a suitor.
Uh-huh.
And there were certain biblical symbols, not biblical, but historical signs that were to be given that they were the right person for the Virgin Mary. One of them was that a bird would land on your staff and that your staff would grow a flower and
okay, so these were sort of folklore tradition that this would be the case, right?
They were folkloric, but apparently they actually happened, because one of the people that had applied for the job to be the suitor for the Virgin Mary was the son of Annas, who eventually became the high priest of the Sanhedrin. And when he was rejected, that's part of the reason why Annas, someone who played a very significant role in the crucifixion of Christ, was angry with the whole process, was because his son was not chosen, and his son was someone of some prestige and notoriety, and they went around for a second round. They sent out a second edict, and Joseph, they had to look through the entire countryside to find out who had not applied, because apparently it was kind of a universal thing that everyone that was in the age category did, and that was single.
And so on the second round, Joseph was basically the second round draft pick.
Right. In the second round, Joseph showed up, got to the temple, and he had a staff, and a flower flew out, and a bird landed on it. And apparently, I don't know how coincidental it might have been, but that's the story, and that's the story from the Gospel of the Virgin Mary, the one that's still in the Vatican Library to this day.
All right. Caller, you're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name, and where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Bob from California.
Hi, Bob.
Hi, how's it going over there?
Well, it's going fine. What's on your mind?
I had kind of an intricate question. It wasn't like intricate, but I think you're...
Okay, can you speak directly into your telephone? We can barely hear you.
I think your notion of God being an extraterrestrial is true and significant in a web of truth about Jesus himself.
Okay.
Well, if physicists believe there's about 9+ dimensions, it seems as if there's intelligent design in a 4-dimensional setting for us. That's obvious. Life can actually form so easily in the right settings. It's almost a clear indication of a good chance that there's intelligent design based on everything we see around us, life. Our bodies are based on these 4 dimensions, though. And sometimes people can calculate things mysteriously 5th-dimensionally. You've all seen shows on it. Those guys that can just keep calculating, because their brains are moving almost 5th-dimensionally.
Do you have a question or comment for the guest?
Yeah, you were saying that if God's or if Jesus is a hybrid, wouldn't that mean that he would almost certainly have, like, you know, some of our characteristics and some of the higher dimensional characteristics, and maybe they just made Mary Magdalene to be more of a whore than, like, a wife, and she was a great person, and he was just put in a political position and got kind of martyred for it, you know?
Don't all
those documents and everything you say and stuff scientifically, documentedly, and logically prove that he was half human and half extraterrestrial, and she loved him, and everything was cool, but the church messed it up? That's my question.
Okay, I don't know if you could hear that. Could you hear that, Glenn?
I could hear it well enough, I think. I think, first of all, it did say in the Bible that Genesis 6, let us make man in our own image. But then you get back to something very contemporary. You can get back to Crick's document. He was the one who unraveled the DNA molecule, wrote the book, the DNA molecule.
All right.
Was the spirit molecule.
Okay.
That's on my website, thimblecollege.com, by the way, if you want a copy. But his conclusion, though he's an atheist, his conclusion was that the DNA necessary to create all human life forms that appeared 3.5 million years ago on the Earth had to have been brought here by an extraterrestrial, because the chances of the DNA suddenly appearing on the Earth 3.5 million years ago was 10 to the 250th power. It actually computated the mathematics of it, and that's way out of line. That's a higher number than every particle of matter in the universe. So his conclusion was it had to come from an extraterrestrial. The only thing I think he left out is that we tend to, in the dark ages of religion and science that we live in, we tend to think that there's some mysterious barrier between science and religion, which is not true. and that it probably was a fourth-level society, according to Michikaku, who talks fluently about the three levels of intelligent beings, but doesn't talk about the fourth-level society. It probably was a fourth-level society person who very much had a DNA structure which could be implanted into terrestrial women.
All right, let's go back to the telephone caller. You're live on the Kevin Smith Show. Your first name and from where are you calling?
Yes, Kevin, this is Steve in Fort Worth.
Hi, Steve.
I was going to ask Glenn, the person of Melchizedek in the Old Testament, does he have any significance in the New Testament?
Melchizedek?
Of course he does. And
yeah.
Melchizedek was the high priest. He was a magi, by the way. He was a temple priest to whom Abraham paid his tithing. If you go to England today to the Royal British Museum, they have a stained glass window called the Window of Melchizedek. And who is Melchizedek anointing to be king of England? You know?
No.
King Arthur.
Ah, yeah, that's cool.
That story is humongous. It's an absolutely humongous tale of how in Hebrews 8, Melchizedek was granted the gift of extended life to the coming of the Messiah. It has so many twists and turns in it that we actually created a CD to that effect called The Great Melchizedek, which is likewise on my website. You can get a copy of it.
And which, by the way, you gave to me. I have it, and I have to say, it's got some astounding, amazing information on it.
Yeah, it's a stunner. Melchizedek was, in fact, one of the principal magi of his day. Was a Nazarene who let his fingers and his hair grow, and he was also one of the angels that visited Lot of Sodom and Gomorrah, because Lot could recognize the three undead beings that were there and invited them to dinner, and they ate dinner with him. And that was Melchizedek.
All right, does that answer your question, Steve? Okay.
That's more than I was anticipating.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you for the call. The telephone number, ladies and gentlemen, is 602-539-9580. 602-539-9580. I'm having to get used to that new number. If you have a question or a comment for Glenn Kimball, please give us a call. And he'll be happy to answer that for you. When you call, be sure that you speak directly into your telephone. If you just sort of have it hanging out there somewhere like we do sometimes, your phone doesn't put enough juice down the line for us to pick it up well. And so you need to speak directly into it. Melchizedek is a mystery. And it's a big mystery and a big topic. And maybe we'll discuss that some more when we come back from this break. Ladies and gentlemen, my guest is Glenn Kimball. When we come back, we'll be on Final Approach. That means we'll have just a few minutes. We'll take your call, maybe two, and then it's over for the evening. We'll be back right about 3 or 4 minutes from now. Welcome back to the Kevin Smith Show. My guest this evening is Glenn Kimball, and the reason I'm saying is I'm making some adjustments here. I just got an email, a flash message that says you have a lot of echo in the mic. Okay, we'll work on that. This is the first night we've had the new telephone system online, and so we'll have some adjustments we have to make. I do apologize for that. And then it says once in a while there's some beeping. What that is, the beeping in this, this is the, with this new telephone system, is when the lines are loaded up and we've got a caller on, we've got a caller on hold, and another call comes in, it starts beeping to let me know. And I've got to find a way to turn that beeping off. We'll find a way. All right, if you have a question or a comment for my guest, Glenn Kimball, please feel free to give us a call. The telephone number is 602-539-9580. Don't wait until there are just a few minutes, like 2 minutes left in the show, and think that we'll answer the call. We won't, because we don't have time for you to say what you want to say and then give Glenn a chance to respond to it. So if you've got a question or a comment, now's the time, because we're fast approaching the point of no return here. All right, Glenn, I think we can sum all of this up by saying something like this, and that is, look, you're saying there is a real historical Jesus. You're saying that there is a great deal more to know about him than what people get out of the Western Bible. And are you also saying that what there is to know is as reliable as what we find in the Bible?
Yes. As a matter of fact, it has greater provenance in many cases.
Okay, now explain. We've talked about provenance, but explain that a little bit. What is that?
Provenance is evidence that it existed. The Western Bible really only came into existence in the 4th century A.D. They were already practicing. The first of upground Christian churches were being built in the 1st century in England. And we know that the Nestorians were active. They were the first Chinese Christians or Oriental Christians in the 1st century A.D. And so their religious writings have been longer than ours in the West. And Eusebius himself talks about the process the Nicene Council used to create the Western Bible. And frankly, in many cases, it was a political decision and not a spiritual decision at all. Arius had 50,000 texts that were included. Eusebius himself was sitting on some 50,000 texts. Caesarea, they had in the Hagia Sophia some 70 or 80,000 texts, and in various churches in Greece they had hundreds of thousands of texts. That doesn't even include the ones that were in Great Britain, the ones in the Silk Road route, the ones in India, the ones in Africa. Good grief. I mean, the story is huge.
You know, we talk about, you mentioned the ones that are in Great Britain. It has amazed me how many people, for instance, they talk about the Roman Emperor Constantine. He was not from Rome. He was the emperor of Rome, but he was not from Rome. He was from Britain.
His father, Constantinus, ruled from Spain and from York in Great Britain. And when his son, it was a divided Caesarship at that point. Constantine unified the Caesarship, but Constantine was a direct descendant of Bishop Linus. Bishop Linus had lived in the Palace of Prudentia, or the Palace of the Britons, which is today located across the street from the Vatican. And so it is extremely likely that Constantine was taught by his mother, St. Helena, Christianity in their home. He only really became converted in one of the warfare experiences he had with his dad in Spain. That brings us to our day about what that Constantine was converted in Spain by seeing some celestial event. Well, that's not true entirely. That's not all the story. He was related to the family.
He was related to which family?
it was related to the first families of Christendom. Christianity was really launched not by Peter and Paul. It was launched by a family of Rufus Pudens and a lady called Gladys and her sister Vencia. Gladys's name was changed to Claudia because she was adopted by Claudius Caesar.
Well, and now they are mentioned in the New Testament too.
Yeah, they're very much mentioned in the New Testament. These people launched Christianity with their efforts. They housed Peter and Paul in their 400. They had 400 servants in this palace across the street from the Vatican.
Of course, the Vatican was not there at that time.
That's correct.
Yeah.
But the palace still is today. The ruins of the palace still are there today. So, you know, we're talking about Christianity as we know it being the earliest portions of Christianity being largely the efforts of one family. And Constantine came from that family. Pardon me, but that's true.
Well, and he was the emperor at the time. He's the emperor that convened the council that decided what books would be in the Bible that everybody's carrying to church with them every Sunday.
And he had to move the center of Rome to Constantinople. He couldn't use Rome anymore because Rome had dismantled the temple in Jerusalem, melted the gold down, and built the Colosseum and killed Christians and Jews in that Colosseum. So he felt like Rome was not the exemplary place to put the center of Christianity. It certainly wasn't Jerusalem. Tiberius Caesar had already begun the disbursement of the Jews during his day. Caligula, when he couldn't take advantage of the money being made off the temple and put his image in the temple, he finished the job.
I hate to interrupt you. We're out of time, and I want you to give your web address again.
That's Kimball College at kimballcollege.com. We're going to have to talk about some of the archaeology found in this country one of these
days. Yeah. And we'll do that.
Lately.
Some archaeology, some stuff that's been found lately?
Yeah, here in this country that no one knows about.
All right, we'll do that. Stay on the phone with me for just a moment. All right, folks, that's it. We're out of time. My friends call me Steel Eye. My enemies do too, and you can call me whatever you want. Just keep coming back again and again and again. Until next time. So long, everybody.